will stay with us as we look at these questions and more on This Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guest now to the program. Steve Bell, activist Stop the War Coalition out of the UK. And Steve Keen, economist and author out of Budapest. Thank you both for being with us.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with, we have two Steves tonight. So Steve Bell, we'll start off in the UK. Let's talk about the legacy of the Troubles. What would you say was learned from that period?
Well, overall, most of the Irish parties in general have been determined to sustain the peace process and to address the questions of legacy. The problem has been that the British government has been extremely unwilling to do that. The reason is clear. The British government, during the Troubles, was engaged in running operatives who were engaged in illegal activity, including assassinations and attacks, particularly upon nationalists. And consequently, they are determined to prevent any investigation into the actual role of British armed forces and allied security personnel during that period. So that previously an agreement was reached between the British government, the Irish government and all the parties in Ireland, particularly in Northern Ireland, about how the legacy of the Troubles and in particular the needs of the victims and the families of the victims should be addressed. What this new bill does is overturn that agreement and simply impose a blanket immunity and above all an immunity for British allied forces in for their actions during the Troubles.
Well, Steve Keen, why do you think that this is happening now? Why does the British government, why did the British government want to overturn this now?
Well, I have to say, first of all, I'm not an expert on the Irish situation, but I'm certainly an observer of it. And my feeling is that this is still a continuation of colonialism by other means. Because if you look at a comparable experience with the Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa at the end of the apartheid period, there was a point where de Klerk and Mandela were jointly running the country, where there was one people, as divided as they might have been, came together to overcome and transcend the horrific past they'd had. And so in that sense, there was a shared feeling that there had to be both truth and reconciliation. And I think, again, I'm not an expert here, but I remember that also involved a similar pledge that nobody would be prosecuted. This, to me, sounds like Britain doesn't want to have its agents exposed. And that's why I think it's more of a colonial thing than it is a genuine attempt to overcome the Troubles. And every time I pass through Northern Ireland, you can still feel the tension there. And this whole idea that we've still got a colonial impact on the British behaviour, I think is extremely worrying.
Well, Steve Bell, let's talk about up until now, there have been inquiries that have taken place since the Good Friday Agreement Let's talk about accomplishments that these hearings have made, if any, and also why it seems that they have been delayed many, many times or suspended. I mean, your overall thoughts on the inquiries up to now.
Yes, there have been some important developments. I mean, the most widely known is undoubtedly the inquiry around Bloody Sunday in January 1972. 14 unarmed Irish protesters and 14 people were killed, 15 others were wounded as a result of actions of the paratroop regiment. Now, this was immediately addressed by the then Conservative government, introducing what was called the Widgery Tribunal. That reported in less than a couple of months and said essentially the problem was the activity of the organisers of a peaceful protest, not the soldiers. It took until 1998 before a further inquiry, the Savile inquiry, began a deeper investigation. After 12 years of work, the Savile inquiry revealed that Widgery had been completely discredited and that it was the soldiers had lied about their activity, and that the those who were died and were injured were basically without blame. Prime Minister Cameron then issued a formal apology to the families of the victims. Now, that's in 2010, but still no justice. As recently as the 25th of August this year, the Bloody Sunday families got an agreement in a ruling in Derry Court that evidence against the soldiers from other soldiers on the day was admissible. If this bill is sustained, then that is the end of it. There will never be actual justice for the Bloody Sunday families. So there has been progress, but exactly that is what this bill aims to do, to prevent a real examination and apportioning of blame about the role of British armed forces.
Well, Steve Keaton, why do you think it has taken so long? I mean, we look at, we're in 2023, and when this happened, I mean, what is going on in your perspective? Why how was the British government able to get away with this for so long and really no one paying a price?
This seems to be a British trend. I mean, look at the Grenfell inquiry. Nothing has happened out of that tragedy years after it occurred. The British seem to basically think if you add time to any problem, that solves the problem. But what they're doing here is provoking the troubles yet again. And to me, it's just a level of political incompetence at the top of the British about everything, Brexit, and including Brexit and its impact upon the Irish situation in the very first instance. So if you add time, troubles go away. That seems to be the British line, and I think it's completely wrong. They're actually likely to provoke the troubles once more rather than have them fade away.
Well, Steve, in Coventry, you said that that none of the soldiers had been prosecuted. What about taking it even above that? Because whenever we see conflict or wars, maybe there are some individual soldiers who may or may not pay the price. But the ones who actually were on top, the prime minister, let us say, at that time, I mean, these individuals seem to always get away with it. So do you think that it would make a difference at this point with the soldiers being prosecuted? What would you like to see?
Well, the prosecution of the soldiers would provide justice to the families. I mean, let's be clear on this. That is what the families have been campaigning for. Since 1972, they've been campaigning for justice for their loved ones. I agree that the soldiers do not simply act on their own initiative, and that all of the counter-insurgency actions of the British government during this period bore the role of a colonial government, and elements of war crimes need to be accounted for. And the actions of British governments of the period have to be opened up. This is exactly what the British government doesn't want to do. It wants to continue to justify such covert and secret operations, which, of course, it's engaged in today in different parts of the world. The British government has managed to isolate itself almost absolutely. All the political parties in Ireland oppose this bill. The Irish government opposes it. The United States government opposes it. The United Nations Human Rights Council said in a ruling in December 22, this bill fails to comply with the state's obligations to investigate serious human rights violations, and it denies truth and remedy for victims. So the EU has also condemned the bill. So this is entirely arrogant by the British government to refuse to listen to anyone outside of its own advisers and to refuse to once again provide any form of justice to the Irish people.
Well, Steve Keane, the UK government says the bill is aimed at, quote, addressing the legacy of Northern Ireland, of the Northern Ireland Troubles, and to promote reconciliation. What are your thoughts about this explanation? They're saying that we need to move on. We will have people and they will come and confess if they have done anything. So we will get the history of what exactly happened. But we need to move on and we need to reconcile.
I think the basic thing is move on. Let's just trying to forget it. This is classic British spin bowling with very incompetent cricketers. So they want their own guilt to go away. The reason I compare it to the South African process is that people really did have their own personal guilt on the line, and the guilt of the security forces as well. And there was a genuine sense of atonement. So that was a successful case of reconciliation. The British want this to basically, let's forget we had a colonial past while we still maintain a colony.
What do you think, Steve, because members of the Irish Republican Party, Sinn Féin, say the only reason for the legislation is basically to hide the truth and to protect British state forces. I mean, why now, though? This is something, a legislation that, of course, could have been enacted years ago. Why now? Why 2023 are we seeing this? Your perspective.
In my view, the British society in general and the Conservative government in particular is facing a crisis in terms of after Brexit has isolated itself internationally, made itself more or less absolutely dependent upon the United States in foreign policy terms. And it has created an atmosphere inside British society whereby there is almost a siege mentality that the rest of the world doesn't understand us, and it's about time they did. This will pass, but nevertheless, that is where we are. And so we have a government completely ignoring all of its so-called allies, certainly ignoring every single Irish voice of substance, and pretending somehow that this is its expression of concern for Irish victims. And it isn't only Irish people. The victims of the Birmingham bombings in 1974, 21 people were killed, will be denied the opportunity to have an inquiry into the deaths of their loved ones by this bill. Equally, citizens of the Irish Republic who lost relatives, perhaps through cross-border action by British-aligned forces, they will not be able to investigate or have an investigation of what happened to their loved ones. This is entirely against any idea of a victim-centred resolution. Instead, this is covering up for the perpetrators.
Well, Steve Keane, can this legislation open up old wounds? I mean, how sensitive is this whole situation still? What's the possibility that will create actually more animosity between the two? I mean, how do you see it?
certainly it'll create more animosity, whether that leads to a renewal of armed conflict and so on. I certainly can't say. I certainly hope not. But this is, you know, they're trying to throw a blanket over a problem to hide their own complicity, and what they're doing is throwing petrol on a fire rather than something to put out the flames. So it is just the self-centeredness of British decision making, which is one thing I've noticed ever since I've spent the last decade living and working in Britain. And I make the analogy, it seems to go back to 1066 when Norman the Conqueror came in and wiped out the Saxon ruling class and put his own people on top. And the attitude from the ruling class was always that the peasants were a different species. And that nature of decision-making still seems to permeate how Britain behaves today. There's just no willingness to admit any wrongdoing on the part of the British government, and that is going to alienate, it could actually alienate both the other sides together, strangely enough, and say, well, the last thing we need is Britain.
Well, Steve Bell, I want you, because a lot of people who are watching this right now were either not born or very young when all of this happened. Talk to us about how divided these areas are still today, which were the focal points of violence during the Troubles area. For example, in Belfast, do we still have division barriers, separate schools, housing? Give us an idea of the sensitivity that still takes place today and what's going on.
Well, there are still divisions, although we have had, I mean, let us not forget this, and this is above all the contribution of people in Ireland itself, both sides of the border. We have had 25 years of relative peace in comparison to the Troubles, and that is the achievement of both the nationalist and unionist community in the six counties and supported by Irish people throughout Ireland. There are, however, tensions, and one has to say that these tensions have been systematically played upon by British government for British government purposes, so that, for example, during the Theresa May government, concessions were made to unionism in order to sustain the Conservatives, without reference to the fact that under the Good Friday Agreement there has to be a parity of respect, and that the nationalist community were not being accorded such respect. There are tensions that can be quite profound. I mean, there are still peace walls in Belfast. But nevertheless, in comparison to prior to the Good Friday Agreement, the Northern Ireland is existing in a state of peace. Now, this bill, in my opinion, will not see a return to the Troubles. But what it will do will be to inflict a terrible scar upon the families and relatives of the victims of the Troubles, a scar that will remain with them throughout their life, or until this bill is repealed and a proper investigation of all the outstanding crimes that their families and relatives underwent is carried out, whether it's an investigation, an inquest, or criminal proceedings if necessary.
Steve Keane, your perspective, what needs to happen? Because this bill hasn't totally been passed, but it is very close. The effects, if it passed, the effects, and is there something that can be done actually to make sure that this legislation isn't enacted?
I don't think it can stop the British enacting the legislation. I think the only real chance of anything positive out of this is if the two sides of the Irish equation come together and say, we have to solve this ourselves regardless of what the British do. The British history has always been a case of taking a minority group and turning it against a majority and putting the minority in control. That was the Muslims versus the Hindus in India. It was the Igbo and the Igbo. There's so many times they've done this. And the Catholics and the Protestants in Ireland is another case of the same thing. The way that this Troubles was actually ended was by the nationalists and the unionists coming together and doing it themselves. And I think ultimately that's the only way to solve this problem. Don't let the British try to solve any problem for you. They're simply trying to disguise their own. do the solution yourselves and tell the Irish where to get off. Tell the rather English where to get off.
Okay, and on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Steve Bell, activist Stop the War Coalition out of Coventry, UK, and Steve Keen, economist and author out of Budapest. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and another group right here in Tehran.
Leader meets with President Raisi and members of his cabinet. On Wednesday, 30th of August, on the occasion of Government Week, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with President Dr. Ebrahim Raisi and members of his cabinet. In this program, we discuss the leader's remarks and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. The 24th to 30th of August each year is designated as Government Week, and this period of time coincides with the martyrdom anniversaries of Muhammad Ali Rajai, the second president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Muhammad Javad Bohonar, the third prime minister of the Islamic Republic. Government Week is an opportunity to compare the performance of the government with earlier ones and appraise and analyze its record. According to an annual tradition, a meeting takes place between the leader of the Islamic Revolution and members of the government during Government Week. The leader gives his appraisal of the performance and record of the government, mentioning any notable or outstanding achievements of the government, and also provides advice on how to improve the government's performance and where more effort is needed. After welcoming President Dr. Ebrahim Raisi and members of his cabinet, Ayatollah Khamenei talked about Government Week and martyrs Muhammad Ali Rajai and Muhammad Javad Bahonar. The leader said Government Week is in fact a link connecting one chapter of the government's life to another chapter. So during this week, you're looking at the year that has just passed whilst also looking at the year ahead. You can make comparisons, you can gain experience, and you can learn lessons from these. This week is adorned with the names of two noble martyrs, Martyr Rajai and Martyr Bahonar. There's a point to note here. What image is in your mind, the mind of these martyrs that you would like our ministers and officials to strive towards? Martyr Rajai was president for about a month, and Martyr Bahonar was prime minister during that same period. Martyr Rajai had also previously been prime minister for several months and had faced a difficult situation at that time. Therefore, we're not concerned with the output of these two honourable men, and we do not have any signs or traces of their work. What we're really concerned about is their intention and their orientation. The orientation of these two dear martyrs was towards God and towards the Islamic Revolution. Those who knew these two close up can verify my words that these two men were pursuing something that all martyrs and all those who fight for the cause of God are pursuing. That is, what they were seeking. In other words, their lives matched their destiny. They sought God's satisfaction, just like all of our martyrs and all those who struggle sincerely for the cause of God. Their goal was to seek God's satisfaction and serve the public, which also brings about God's satisfaction. So this is the important point. The key words are seeking God's satisfaction and working to serve the people. Our goal should be summed up in these two things. If God's satisfaction becomes our goal, it will affect all of our activities, all of our actions, and the way we work. Referring to the Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya regarding God's satisfaction, the leader quoted a sentence from Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, who asked God Almighty, "Bless me that I may prefer your satisfaction over everything else, both in the case of friends and enemies. If a person is like this, then my enemy will be safe from any wrongdoing and injustice from me, and my friend will not worry about favours from me or misplaced kindness from me." Government Week this year marked exactly 2 years since the formation of the 13th government, headed by President Dr. Ebrahim Raisi. After listening to President Raisi's report and that of various ministers, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the biggest achievement of President Raisi's government as revival of hope and trust among the people, the general population, and emphasised that the performance of this government has been praiseworthy. The leader said the government has tried to tackle problems head-on and it has listened to what the people say. Ayatollah Khamenei said another positive point about the government is that it distrusts Western powers and does not count on them in any way. The leader added, "This is a fundamental point and is very important for independence and self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic of Iran." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader said, "I will briefly give you my opinion and judgment about the administration, and I will also remind you about a few matters that you need to pay attention to. As for my judgment, well, over the past 30 or so years, I have supported all the various administrations with different orientations and abilities, and the reason for that is obvious. The situation of the country and the goals we have set for ourselves in the Islamic Republic requires everyone to help the executive branch of the government, including the leader, the people, intellectuals and influential figures, and everyone else. That's how it works. All governments deserve this support, and we have helped all previous governments. However, considering what I have seen during these past 2 years regarding this administration, in addition to giving my support, I would also like to praise this administration. What we have seen from this administration's performance during the past 2 years it has been in office warrants our appreciation and our praise. The reason I'm saying this is because the administration has unfortunately not been articulate enough in telling others about the things that it has accomplished, it has achieved. Some good things have taken place that have not been conveyed to the people in the way that they should have been done. I would like to mention a few of these things so that the facts and realities of this administration would be clearer to the general public and to those who are not prejudiced. Turning to the state of the economy, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "In the economic sector, good things have been done by the government, the details of which were explained to some extent by the President and Vice President. What I would like to emphasize is that a significant number of macroeconomic indicators signal economic growth. They signal economic progress and positive change. Of course, it will take some time before the effects of these macroeconomic issues will be seen in people's everyday lives and livelihood. Some governments tend to sacrifice the future for the present, but that is not what this administration has done. It has done a great deal of good fundamental work, the effects of which will be seen later, even though they may not be fully apparent today. I will mention a few of those things. Increased economic growth, especially in the industrial sector, is important. There has been increased growth in investment, which is one of our most important economic issues. Our main problem in some previous periods was the issue of investment, which had a negative growth. There has been a reduction in unemployment, a reduction in the Gini coefficient, a significant growth in the export of goods, and a strengthening of the tax system. The government's tax revenues have been able to provide a significant part of the government's current budget. Commenting on the petrochemical industry, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "We have seen a significant growth in the production of petrochemical products. The issue of petrochemical products is one of the important issues in the country. Valuable steps have been taken in the field of oil and gas production, one of which was the completion and inauguration of Phase 11 of the South Pars gas field. Another important activity is the reopening of closed or partially closed workshops. Several thousand closed or partially closed factories and workshops have been reopened. This is very important. Other important work is in connection with water supply, irrigation and drainage networks in various places." In further remarks, the leader said, "The 13th government is doing a poor job of informing others about its achievements. In other words, the basic task of informing others is not being done. Communicating information is an art in itself. To communicate this information properly, you need flair and expertise." Commenting on the day-to-day problems that people face, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Expenses are high, especially food prices and housing costs, and these are daily problems that people face. People see these things instead, and so the important, valuable work that is being done in the economic sector is naturally going unnoticed. It becomes like a layer of dust that stands in the way of our fundamental activities. the 13th government needs to seriously and urgently think about this problem. Turning to the subject of serving the people, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "We have no right to talk to people from a position of superiority or arrogance, because we're not anybody special and all that exists belongs to the people. If we have been given a position, a job or a responsibility to fulfill, well, first of all, it has been given to us by the people, and secondly, it has been given to us to serve the people." The leader added, "The simple lifestyle and working behavior of the administration, especially with regards to the president himself, is impressive to me. This is something important and worthy of attention. The revolutionary mindset, the jihadi spirit that is shown in some of the government's activities, and recruitment of young people in various managerial positions are all very important matters." Turning to foreign policy, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "The government's dynamism in its foreign policy is very good. This policy that you have adopted, having relations with neighbouring countries, is a very good policy. It should be further developed. We should not have disputes with any of our neighbours. If there is a dispute, it should be turned into cooperation. And we should have relations with all the governments in the world that are interested in having relations with us. We have relations with different countries in South America, in Africa, Asia, East Asia, and elsewhere. This policy of establishing numerous, diverse relations with various countries is the correct thing to do. Becoming a member of two important international alliances, BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in a short space of time was also a very good achievement of the 13th government. Not only does it benefit the country, but it also points to this reality. Countries around the world want us to join these alliances, such as BRICS and the SCO. Good things have been done in the cultural sector too, which of course should be increased both in quality and in terms of quantity." The leader added, "I have repeatedly said that the country's main priorities are the economy and our culture. These are our top two priorities. As for the economy, our slogan has two parts this year. One is about controlling inflation, and the other is about increasing production and boosting manufacturing. With regards to controlling inflation, I stated in my speech at the beginning of the Iranian New Year that controlling inflation is also possible with the growth in production. In other words, the most important thing that can be done to control inflation is to raise our production level and manufacturing output." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei also offered advice on how to improve the government's performance and what more needs to be done. He offered advice on a range of issues, including making use of elites, intellectuals and academics, fighting corruption, having a more active international diplomacy, foreign trade and exports, reducing our dependency on the US dollar, identifying what the country really needs in a timely manner, supporting and backing high-tech knowledge-based companies, and using talented young people and university graduates in industry. In final remarks, the leader wished success and prosperity to President Dr. Ebrahim Raisi and members of his cabinet.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pariza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
24-year-old Chris Carver left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control, and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, 1 year on, Carver's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.
They have waited years for justice that will never come. Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age. She was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on their own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence, by the state itself, everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice, and at the very least, to investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2. Of European advancing, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution, an attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
There were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved, and it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has been 22 years since the Pentagon and the two World Trade Center buildings were attacked by planes, ushering in a totally unexpected and deeply destructive era of world history. As usual, in big cities and small towns across the United States, 9/11 was remembered with ceremonies and the same propaganda slogans from decades ago.
22 years ago, hatred and terror did not win. It did not destroy America. Freedom and democracy and the very pillars of this great nation continue to endure.
The biggest domestic legacy of the death of 3,000 civilians may be the internal spying, repression, and paranoia which immediately followed and continues today.
We've gone into a permanent emergency state. That's the key. And it began right after 9/11 with the passage of what was called the U.S. Patriot Act. Everything's a crime, everything's an emergency. The SWAT team raids in America, which are crazy, it's where police are dressed in military gear here. They crash through doors in the middle of the night. They've shot children, old men, veterans. It's so far gone, it's going to be very difficult to roll it back.
Washington's unprecedented and digital domestic dragnet would soon be copied by their allies, especially the United Kingdom, France, and the European Union.
All the great dictators said this, is that we need a sleepwalking people. You need to make people afraid. Once they get fearful, it's called the government needs national security. We need to clamp down everybody. We need to arrest people. And we saw a lot of that, by the way, right after 9/11. It's a way to promote hate against everybody in the world. They don't want us to get along. They want us to disagree. And long as we're disagreeing and fighting, they remain in power.
Washington's vengeful response to 9/11 was their declaration of a so-called global war on terrorism. It is now blamed for causing 4.5 million deaths, directly and indirectly, and the displacement of 45 million people. However, there's little domestic discussion regarding the awful impact of Washington's militaristic response on the anniversary of 9/11 or on any other day.
The events of 9/11 transformed our nation and how we view our national security. It also transformed each of us individually in ways that we don't always talk about publicly.
The prisoners of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, the militarization of American society, the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, so many murdered non-American civilians. 22 years after, the list of victims of 9/11 is still growing. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
One year has passed since the fatal shooting of a British black man by a London Metropolitan Police officer, an incident which sparked a huge protest movement across the UK and demands for police reform amid widespread accusations of racism. 24-year-old Chris Carver left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, 1 year on, Carber's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea Friday celebrated the 75th anniversary of its founding, with leader Kim Jong-un and his daughter observing a large military parade and fireworks in Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung Square. On this occasion, the parade did not include missiles or large weapons. However, analysts suggest such events, which have taken place frequently in recent years, send a message.
These great parades and celebrations in North Korea serve both domestic and international purposes. They show the rest of the world that this regime is standing up to South Korea and to the United States and to Japan, and that it's ready to fire nuclear warheads if they attack North Korea.
Delegations from the DPRK's traditional allies, China and Russia, traveled to Pyongyang for the occasion, demonstrating stronger ties amid a shift toward more difficult relations with South Korea. The past year and a half have been particularly tense on the Korean Peninsula. Coming to office in May of 2022, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol resumed large-scale joint military exercises with the United States, and North Korea conducted more missile tests than ever before. The celebrations in Pyongyang come following reports Russia may purchase artillery shells and other weapons from the DPRK. The U.S. earlier this week issued a stern warning.
Providing weapons to Russia for use on the battlefield to attack grain silos and the heating infrastructure of major cities as we head into winter, to try to conquer territory that belongs to another sovereign nation, this is not going to reflect well on North Korea, and they will pay a price for this in the international community.
Despite that warning from the U.S., multiple reports indicate DPRK leader Kim Jong-un will travel next week to Russia to again meet for talks with President Vladimir Putin. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The sounds of bombs, explosions, airstrikes, and screams are the only sounds the children of Jinin refugee camp have been hearing for years. Today they are screaming and yelling, but this time out of joy and happiness. The Freedom Theater that is nestled in the Jinin refugee camp was established in 2006 as a center for artistic expression and creative activism. The theater aims to empower the local community, especially young Palestinian refugees, through performing arts. It has become a safe haven for children to heal, if only a little bit, from the unseen wounds they suffer from under Israeli occupation and the recent attacks on their camp.
The Israeli attacks, the Israeli invasion make this place a very difficult place, a very violent place. And that's what we are fighting for, to have this safe space for children. We're fighting to make the children in the camp grow up as a normal children. They have to have normal time as a children. With this kind of reality, while the Israeli attacks all the time, they are scared. They're having problems to sleep in the night. The bombs, the violence in the street. So they don't grow as children.
Minors between ages of 14 and 15 come to the theater 2 days a week to attend drama workshops. The main aim is to tackle the fear and trauma children here are living through, especially after the latest Israeli military raid.
The Freedom Theater is my second home. I love to come here to learn and play, to take part in plays, to entertain other children after what we saw during the Israeli incursions that has left martyrs and destruction and prisoners.
Theater means everything to me. We can find a space to express ourselves after the hard circumstances we go through and after the latest raid. Here I can gather with my friends, we laugh and play and feel safe. The teachers here take us on journeys and we visit other Palestinian cities.
Younger children, however, are the most affected by the current situation, and the Freedom Theater continues to hold therapy workshops for such kids. The theater's experts and coordinators, who directly work with the children, say many of them are too traumatized to speak, and that's why they use art as a tool for expressing what they feel. They say art can convey what sometimes cannot be said.
During the recent raids on Jenin, the children were affected both direct and indirectly. We tried to give them a space just to play. Many of the children returned after the raids, suffering from shocks, worry, and fear. One of our goals is to let children express their feelings. We try to explain to them that there are different forms of resistance. Remaining in our land and learning at school is another form of resistance.
Last July, during the deadly military raid on the refugee camp, many were killed and wounded, and the theater and its vicinity were damaged. But it emerged from the ashes and immediately organized activities to cheer up the camp's children through drawing and singing. The Freedom Theater in Jenin refugee camp continues to provide some relief to the camp's children. This theater has survived miraculously despite difficult situations at the camp, Israeli occupation, and more recently airstrikes during the latest Israeli military operation in the camp. Mona Qandil occupied Jenin refugee camp.
The United States announced they are sending depleted uranium shells for tanks to Ukraine, even though they pose the risk of serious civilian health issues for generations. The use of such toxic shells by the United States in Fallujah, Iraq, is often blamed there for an increase in cancer, birth defects, and infant mortality. Depleted uranium shells now follow F-16 fighter jets, cluster munitions, tanks, and other escalatory measures which Washington had said they would refrain from using in the conflict.
Piles that much more of an atrocity on the atrocities that we're already committing, the atrocity of overthrowing the democratically elected leadership of Ukraine and forcing it into a 9-year race war. Is a horror that should have taught Americans long before this that their government does not care about Ukraine, does not care about Russia, and it's a hard pitch to say that they care about America either.
The toxic shells were announced during a surprise visit to Kiev by the United States Secretary of State, where he announced another $1 billion in funding.
The new security funding that we're announcing today will also be bolstered by the arrival of U.S. Abrams tanks this fall, and by training for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in the United States, complementing training that is already underway in Europe. In the ongoing counteroffensive, progress has accelerated in the past few weeks. This new assistance will help sustain it and build further momentum.
So far, the U.S. has given some $80 billion to Ukraine, or an average of nearly $1 billion per week since the unrest increased in February 2022. All the Western military aid has so far failed to succeed. The Ukrainian counteroffensive has barely dented Russian defenses. Western tanks often smolder on the battlefield. U.S. leaders now admit the war will continue for years. The obvious Russian success has many questioning the alleged military supremacy of the United States and NATO.
I think that there's no way that the West can win this war, and we're not fighting it to win it. We're fighting it to wear Russia down, using Ukraine as our blunt instrument to wear Russia down, smashing our friends, our allies, into the brick wall in hopes of knocking a few bricks out. But the narrative that has been sold to, is being relentlessly sold to Americans, is that we're on the verge of winning.
Congress is currently negotiating a bill for another $20 billion in weapons, even as polls show 55% of Americans don't want more funding for Ukraine. The influx of money has led to such rampant allegations of bribery that it just forced the replacement of Ukraine's Minister of Defense. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
In the limelight.
Experts say Francis Abayaban is clearly a distraction